But right now, I'm very happy to introduce to you Andy Kroll. He's a reporter with Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com, an informative online magazine founded by Tom Englehart. Andy Kroll's recent article is titled "Flatlining the Middle Class: Economic Numbers to Die For." And Andy, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Andy, in this article, you examine the economic indicators of the American middle class and elsewhere in our economy that seems to be approaching collapse, with evidence of the last 10 years and a grim outlook for the next 10 years. Maybe you can sort of summarize exactly what you found there in terms of the economic data.
What I did, and which anyone could have done, was really marshal this flurry of economic data that we've had for maybe the past 7 or 8 months, and sort of bring it all together in one piece and talk and sort of present it all and make a strong case for how the last decade was a lost decade for the American middle class and the American working class, and that the decade we're in right now, as young as it is shaping up to be the same thing. And what I did was I looked at data from the census about household incomes and what the average middle class family was taking home in a year's, in just 1 year's span. And what I found was that between 2000 and 2010, the average typical middle class family was taking home about $4,000 less than they were 10 years earlier, 7% drop, from about $49,000 going down, it's $49,000 in 2010, and it was slightly more than that before. But so in this 10-year period, we saw income for the middle-class family actually decline. I look at poverty numbers, which absolutely exploded in the past decade, and really just in recent years. We have 46 million men, women, and children who are now officially declared poor, and that's 15% of the population. And so I look at a bunch of different indicators that really point to, if we want to borrow the language of the Occupy Wall Street folks, the other 99% has had a really tough go, not just in the last 10 years, in the last 20, the last 30. And all this information we're getting right now continues to reinforce that point.
Andy, what can you tell us about the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the inequality that's been going on not just since 2008 and the start of this Great Recession, but the inequality that's been creeping along and growing wider and wider over recent decades?
Yeah, I mean, the incredible income inequality we have now is by no means a result of just this past decade, this lost decade that I described. I mean, we're talking about going back to like 1970, the late 1970s. 1979 is a place where economists like to begin their charts showing us how the inequality between earners and the American population has really become so drastic. And we've just seen, for the top 1%, the top 1%, their wealth, the average income that they bring home has grown from about $500,000 to nearly $2 million, which is quite an impressive increase since about 1979. But when you look at everyone else, the other 99%, if you will, or the bottom 80%, it's really, the line is flat. Incomes have barely increased, if they have at all. And in fact, for the middle class earners and working class earners, the change in how much money they're making is actually decreasing. And so this gap has been growing for 30 years, and it shows no signs really of narrowing at all. And that's a result of tax policy. It's a result of changing American economy and jobs being offshored or jobs just being disappeared in general, manufacturing jobs. There's a lot of factors at play here. But that gap's not getting any narrower.
Exactly. Let's talk about tax policy, because since 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, we've seen a steep decline in the amount and percentage of money that the wealthy of this country has paid in taxes. And the same holds true with the major corporations in this country, to the point where we have some companies like major companies like General Electric that pay no taxes at all, while you know, we see the burden falling disproportionately on middle class and other working families. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, since the Reagan presidency, and even actually starting before the Reagan presidency and the Carter presidency, Carter administration, we've seen tax rates for the wealthiest continually decrease. You've seen tax rates for corporations decrease. And really, and for corporations, it's not only that the tax rate has declined, but also that the tax code has just been poked full of loopholes for any number of subsidies, whether it's subsidies for oil and natural gas companies, whether it's subsidies for certain kinds of investments. You've seen the tax code, the books that actually contain the physical text of the tax code, they stack many feet high into the air just because the tax code is so dang complicated today. And the president has talked about simplifying the code, maybe either lowering it and broadening the base, which is to say bringing more people into it. But the general trend since the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration really is lower taxes for the top 1%, the top 0.1% even. And, as a result, we've seen a growing concentration of wealth in those very, very wealthy elites, and everyone else seems to be losing their share of the pie while the share keeps growing among that very small, small piece of the population.
We're speaking tonight with Andy Kroll, reporter with Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. We're talking about his article, Flatlining the Middle Class, Economic Numbers to Die For. And Andy, would you review for us some of the poverty statistics, particularly the poverty we see rising among minorities, blacks, Hispanics, and children that you outline in your article?
Yeah, The numbers, just generally speaking, for the population are pretty grim. But when you really get into, you dig deep within it, it's very, very, very bad, as I've written before, for blacks and Hispanics and children as well. The black poverty rate ticked upward between just 2009 and 2010 from 25% to 27%. For Hispanics, it's right on that same number that increased 25% to 26%, whereas when you're talking about whites, it's about 10% right now. And it also increased from 09 to 10 for whites, but the poverty rate is nowhere near what it is for blacks and Hispanics. And for kids, it's about 22%, which is the highest it's been since, within 17 years, this 20% child poverty rate. And so, put simply, you're talking about having one in four black Americans is officially in poverty. And to be clear about what poverty actually is, the poverty line for a family of four is about $22,000. $22,000. For a single person who is older than 18, it's $11,000. So we're not talking about really any money at all here. I mean, it's hard to imagine how you could get by as a family of four on $22,000, yet one in four blacks is officially in poverty, one in four Hispanics, nearly one in four of every American child is in poverty. So these are absolutely, these numbers floor you. They can seem abstract just because they're statistics, but if you just put, break it down, one in four black or Hispanics is in poverty, it's absolutely incredible. And even the Census Bureau, when they rolled out these numbers recently, they went to great lengths to explain, how historic this kind of poverty we're seeing right now really is.
How dramatic a break are the numbers we're seeing in terms of poverty and the decline in income and wealth in this country from earlier decades? And there's a lot of discussion right now, of course, as to how quickly we could recover from the current economic decline, or the larger question is, can we recover at all?
Well, to put the poverty numbers into perspective, they are the highest in the last couple of decades, as I just explained, especially for blacks and Hispanics. They are some of the highest since the Census Bureau has been keeping track of these figures. I mean, we're talking figures that are becoming on par with the Great Depression. They're not quite at that level, but they're getting there. And so, you know, we're living through a pretty historic, a depressingly historic period. And the interesting thing, looking at this recovery, you don't even want to call it that, recovery in quotations, is that it's a jobless recovery. It's a very sluggish recovery. And as we saw in the New York Times today, a front page story talked about how the decline in income between the period of the actual, you know, officially designated recession, which technically ended in 2009, which most people think is bogus, and I would agree. But people, the income for Americans, average American income, actually declined more in the 2 years after the recession was officially declared over than it did in the actual recession itself. And so the big takeaway for me is, well, this isn't a recovery at all. And in fact, we're still slogging through the same kinds of, the same bog, economic bog, if you will, that we were in 2009, in 2010, or even 2008. The housing bubble had burst, and in the fall, the financial industry basically imploded. So there are no real signs for a recovery, or if they are, they're far and few between, and very, very small. The housing market is still pretty sluggish, showing some signs of turning up, but not many. And the unemployment rate is still, you know, in the 9% range, and we're only adding 100,000 or so jobs every month. To put that in perspective, the labor market, the workforce in this country needs to add 100,000 jobs a month just to keep up with population growth, which means we're not going anywhere. We're not moving forward at all. We're treading water. You need about 250,000, 300,000 to actually start making progress. That's not happening right now, and economists really struggle to suggest when it would happen. Maybe President Obama's jobs bill can go towards speeding that up, but right now, no one can say for certain, and we're just stuck in this mess.
I've read comparisons about the current situation here in the U.S. and other countries around the world to what Japan experienced when they had an economic downturn there decades ago, and that's kind of been the status of things in Japan for a number of years, that they've been economically stagnant with a lot of problems that persist there. Have you read similar comparisons, or, you know, is there any signpost there that we can see our future on?
I actually I tried to draw some comparisons or draw some parallels with the Japanese lost decade, as you mentioned, which really was through the 1990s, and the lost decade that I described in the 2000s for the middle class in America. You know, it's a complicated comparison. You know, there are a lot of issues about monetary policy, interest rates that come into play when you compare Japan and the U.S. I mean, the big takeaway that I had, and this was from reading the work of a really good professor at, I'm trying to get his name, I was going to say Adam Posner, but I might be wrong, a really good economist who's written about, who's really developed the Japanese lost decade guru. And the big piece that I took away was how the Japanese lost decade was unnecessarily prolonged because policymakers just didn't have the guts to really take drastic, you might even say radical action to grab the problem by the scruff of the neck and really try to jumpstart the economy through government intervention until the private sector could really get on its feet and get up to full speed and chugging along. And for me, that just, you know, reading about how the Japanese waffled and they thought about going big but didn't end up doing it, and they sort of got stuck in this huge stagnant period, reminded me of the U.S. We had the stimulus, which, don't let anyone tell you otherwise, had a significant effect, and really just it wasn't quite enough of what the economy needed. there wasn't a big enough booster shot, if you will. And right now the Congress is debating the president's jobs bill and not looking like they're going to pass it. They say they want to break up into pieces, which often means breaking up into pieces and then killing all those pieces, except for maybe tax cuts. And so the comparison that I see, or the painful as it is policymakers sort of dithering in both countries as they try to grapple with a historic problem and not recognizing the magnitude of it and really tackling it head on.
Andy Kroll is our guest, and we're talking about his article, Flatlining the Middle Class, Economic Numbers to Die For. And people can read that at TomDispatch.com, right, Andy?
Yep.
And we'll give that address out one more time before we leave. But as you look at all the young people who are attracted to the Occupation Wall Street movements that are sprouting up all over this country, what is it that drives that activism, in your view? And does it have something especially to do with dimming prospects for young people who are trying to gather up money to go to college or have graduated from college with huge debts and really see no prospect for a career, for jobs in their future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the things you described and much more. I spent the weekend in Manhattan. Spent a lot of time at Occupy Wall Street down in Zuccotti Park, this shoebox-shaped sort of spit of land just blocks from Wall Street in the shadow of Ground Zero. And I talked to young people, I talked to old people, I talked to libertarians, liberals, centrists. They're not too much connected to the center anymore. They may not have a clearly defined set of demands, as they have been criticized for, and as a lot of people have pointed out, is actually a good thing. But the drivers of Occupy Wall Street, of all the other Occupy protests springing up around the country, and also of the protests we saw in Wisconsin earlier this year, is dimming economic prospects. It's income inequality. It's graduating with $120,000 in debt and having to work at a call center or busing tables. It is the loss of opportunity, and not just having someone hand you a job, but even having the ability or the chances to go out and find something. I mean, the jobs just aren't out there for young people and old people and middle-aged people, of course. And it really is. It's a sense of drift. It's a sense of disillusionment that the economy does not work for 99% of the American population. That drives Occupy Wall Street, and it's, you know, the issue of income inequality and the things I wrote about in this article. You know, those for me have always been the most fascinating story and something that people needed to home in on. Because since the 80s, this has been the real issue, is the widening gap and student crushing student loan debt and economic opportunity. And that it really is the foundation of Occupy Wall Street. It's on the signs, it's in the speeches, it's in the Occupied Wall Street Journal, their official newspaper. And it's really taking the issues that I present in this article and turning them into action.
Andy, just a final question. As someone who's examined the economics of where the country has been and where it's headed now, how do you explain so many people voting against their self-interest when it comes to economics over recent decades, when the middle class has been under attack, it's shrinking, it's certainly in extremely bad shape, as you talk about in this article right now? How does a political party such as the Republicans and certainly some sectors of the Democrats who advocate excessively and singularly for the wealthiest 1%. How are they viable? How are these politicians viable at all at the ballot box, you know, with people going there to vote against themselves? I'm just wondering what you think the psychology is there.
This is the what's the matter with Kansas question that Thomas Frank, a really good writer and political scientist, brings up in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Exactly.
You know, I think, you know, or at least citing him, one theory is that, you know, the Republican Party has sold itself on cultural issues, and they've either they've distracted, say, flyover country, middle America, the Midwest where I'm from. They've distracted people there from a shrinking middle class, from flatlining wages, from disappearing health care benefits and the like, by hyping up abortion or gun rights or any of the other culture war issues that come up. That's what Frank says, and I think to a large degree he's right. I mean, how else can you explain people who vote against their self-interest? You know, another point that came up at Occupy Wall Street that I thought was interesting was, you know, there's a sense among people that it's not just Republicans either. The Democrats may pay lip service to trying to restore the middle class and create a more fair tax policy, but, you know, they also do the bidding of large banks, especially Democrats. They also do the bidding of large banks and health insurance companies and other large corporations. So I think it goes both ways, but I think it was a distraction from economic issues with cultural fighting. But I think right now we're getting to such a dire point, going back to these statistics again, that I point out that you can't distract people as easily anymore because the economics are so dire.
Exactly. God's gaze and guns when it comes to elections for the right wing. Unfortunately, things are so dire, as you said, it doesn't work anymore. It's a trick that you can't pull out of your toolbox anymore.
Hopefully not. I think that if Democrats really want, and I think they're going to do this anyway, if they really want to hammer home a message that's going to work, it's got to be one rooted in economics and the middle class and entitlement programs and, you know, those core issues, you know, go straight to the wallet, go straight to the checkbook.
Well, Andy, we're out of time. Thanks so much for spending time with us and for doing this article, which really puts all those horrible pieces of economic data in one place. Our listeners will want to see it if they haven't read it yet. What's the web address so that they can get a look and read that article, Andy?
Yeah, well, I would say MotherJones.com. Make it your homepage, bookmark it. We have superb newsletters that will send our best stuff right to your inbox. And also, TomDispatch.com as well is really great. And again, you get our thrice weekly newsletter, and we'll help you navigate this crazy world we're living in, and give you what you need and not what you don't.
All right, well, Andy, thanks for all your hard work, and we'll hope to have you back soon to talk more about this kind of issue.
Thank you.
All right, take care, Andy.
Okay.
Bye bye. That's Andy Kroll, reporter with Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. We're talking about his article, Flatlining the Middle Class, Economic Numbers to Die For, which, as I said, really does give you the depth and breadth of this economic collapse for the middle class. And it has some very negative stats in one place that give you a better understanding of what's happening in this country.